Bedfoot errors, and we have a different one that corrects against Bedfoot errors. But we'd like to combine those two things into one. So how are we going to do that? Well, we can somehow try to do both things at once, right? And so the solution to this is not to use 3 qubits, we're going to have to use more qubits than that. We use 9 qubits. So this is the 9 qubit code. Also known as the Schur code, because it was coming by Schur. And, well, so what we're going to do is we're going to encode the logical zero as this state, 3 copies of the superposition 000 plus 111. And logical 1 is going to be 3 copies of 000 minus 111. And of course, the superposition, or entangled state, is going to be the appropriate superposition of these things. Okay, so how does this work? Well, we can correct bit flip errors. X errors. On each set of 3. And the way we do that is just as we did before. We look to see which one of them is different by looking to see if the first 2 of them are different, the second 2 are different. Okay? So that's just the same. It doesn't matter that these are part of a bigger state, because again, it was working on the time states. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. So it's clear that this is correct x error on a single qubit. Actually, we can correct x errors on 2 or even 3 qubits, so long as they're in different sets of 3. But we can't guarantee that if we have a 3 qubit error, it'll all be in different sets of 3. So we won't allow that. We'll just have 1 error. So what about a z error? Well, okay, so this is a little more subtle. I'm not going to go through the details, although we'll return to this either at the end of today or next week. But in some sense, this is a lot like this phase flip correcting code, because it has 3 plus signs here, or 3 minus signs. So as before, we can correct phase flips by comparing if those plus signs are all the same. Well, not if they're plus signs or minus signs, but seeing if the signs are all the same. Right, in a correct encoded state, they should all be the same. But when there's been a phase flip error, say if the 6th qubit gets flipped, then this sign up here would be minus, and this one would be plus. And so we have plus, minus, plus, or minus, plus, minus. And either way, the middle phase would be different. And so we can figure out that it's different and figure out which one is different, just the same way we did before in the 3 qubit phase correction code. So this is a code that corrects an X error or a Z error. So that's a big improvement over what we had before. Unfortunately, we had to go to more qubits, right? And you might think that this would have to continue to increase. As we add more and more errors that we want to correct, we'd have to go to more and more qubits. But look what happened. This X error correction was completely independent of this Z error correction. So there's no reason we couldn't do this one and then this one. Right? We want to ruin the state at all by doing that. So in fact, we can correct not just an X error or a Z error, but an X error and a Z error. In a lot of things, marked the same way, we can correct an X error on this set of 3 and an X error on this set of 3, on 1 qubit within each of those sets of 3. Okay? And in particular, we can correct the case where the x error and z error are on the same qubit, and that's a y error. If we have a y error on a single qubit, we can correct that too. So this is a code that can therefore correct on any single qubit an x error, y error, or z error. And of course, if we don't have any of those, we have the identity, then we're okay too. Okay? So that is solution for our problem number three.
So that is, formally, are you saying that the observables commute for x error and y error?
Yes, they do. But independent is somehow saying more than that. That the information we're gathering to find out where the x errors are is completely independent of the information that we're gathering to tell us where the z errors are. And they don't, neither one of them is, we're not reusing information in any way. So this is a one-qubit error, so we don't have to think about correlation between these things. But
you really did mean that, right? I mean, they could have occurred in different qubits, and even then they're independent.
Well, that's right. But this means something. I'm thinking of something very specific, technical, but I don't want to get into it because it depends on stuff we'll do over the next, probably the next lecture. But it's definitely more than that the operators are doing it. Yeah.
So Daniel, I mean, basically simply from the fact that they leave the qubits untouched, right? I mean, the detection procedure leaves the qubits untouched means that, you know, I can find one and then follow up with the other.
Well, no. I mean, yes, kind of. That's relevant. But, so first of all, it might be that the process of correcting one error, it leaves the encoded state untouched, but it doesn't necessarily leave the error untouched. Okay, and that's actually going to be very important in the next point.
So one can just find out the location of the error, the big flip error, and then check for the location of the phase loop error. I'm not corrected.
Well, in this case, that's true. But in more general cases, that won't necessarily be true. Again, it's something that maybe we can return to in a later lecture. But today, I'd like to put it off for the moment. For this particular code, it's OK to do that. And for comparing x and z error. But there's a lot of cases where it's not. So. It's kind of similar problem came up last time I gave this course, and I then gave a homework problem on it, which you don't have the background to do yet. But the problem was to find a code that could correct an x error and a z error, but not also a y error. Okay, and there are such codes. So by x error and z error, I don't mean simultaneously. It could correct. If there's an error on one qubit, that's an x error or a z error. That's okay, but it can't correct the possibility of having x, y, and z as three separate things. So you can look on the webpage for the last course. You don't have the background yet. Next lecture. After next lecture, look on the webpage for the course if you're interested in the problem. And you'll see the solution set of that problem. But it was the problem set number one. Yeah.
The way you construct your code, it seems that you can correct bit flip on every set of three.
Yeah.
But it seems that you can correct only phase flip for one error.
That's correct.
Right?
That's right. So it's definitely treating the bit flips and phase flips asymmetrically.
Okay.
And that's kind of the reason why that's one of the reasons why I'm just restricting this to correcting one error. Because while I might be able to correct, you know, multiple bit flip errors, I'm much worse off when it comes to correcting multiple phase errors.
So Daniel, at least in this code, we can always postpone the...
In which code?
The
repetition, three-qubit repetition code?
Yeah, three-qubit repetition or the short code. We can just postpone, we can detect both of them and postpone the correction to the end, right?
Yeah, that's certainly true. But the point is that the information you're gathering about these different errors is not, in general, independent of each other. And if you have too many possibilities, you can't distinguish them. It's too early to explain. But once we have, a more general theory of error correcting code, I think that can make it much clearer. Okay, so putting that question aside, are there questions maybe that I'm willing to answer now? It's worth a try, right? You never know. Okay, so at this point, I've solved the first three problems. You'll forgive me if I don't check it off, since it's so much work to get that down. So let's look about this fourth problem. Okay, so at least we didn't to deal with the y error, we didn't have to add j more qubits, so 9 was enough. But now we have this infinite set of possible errors. We're expanding all possible single qubit errors. So how are we possibly going to get that? And the answer is, we're just going to pretend that that's not a possibility. We're just going to be dumb, and we're going to say, okay, we'll do this sure 9-qubit code, and we'll just deal with x, y, and z errors and the identity. Okay, so what happens if we do that? Well, let's erase this one. Okay, so let's consider this phase rotation, where I've been erased for it, so it would still be here. So r theta is e to the minus I theta and the plus I theta on the back. Okay, and we can write that as, e to the I theta plus or minus I theta is cosine theta plus or minus I sine theta. So if we look at the cosine theta term, that's the same along the diagonal, and the sine theta term is opposite sine. So this is equal to cosine theta times the identity minus I sine theta times z. And I guess I failed to comment on it before, but now you know I'm American. I should warn you, though, the last time I took this, I taught this class, at the beginning of the class, the students were asking questions z, 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 and I was answering z, z, z. But by the end of the class, they had started saying z, so mark that.
But then you seem to have a mixed heritage, because your z is written.
So the reason I do that is because otherwise they look like twos.
It's very z-ish.
Okay, so anyway, so we've expanded this r theta in terms of I and z. And, what does that mean? What is the point of doing that? Well, the point is that quantum mechanics is a linear operation. All operations in quantum mechanics are linear operations. So when we do error correction, just using the dumb thing of thinking that it's x, y, or z, well, we can extend that to this type of error. We can still see what's going to happen to it. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work, although it will, but we can at least analyze it. So what's going to happen? Well, so we take our encoded state, sidebar, and assume that we have this r theta error acting on qubit number I. Okay? Well, that's equal to this. So that's cosine theta sidebar minus I sine theta make this J, so I don't get confused with the complex I. Sign to Z on J, sidebar. Okay? And suppose then we do the syncrome measurement procedure. Well, this state would go sidebar, would go to sidebar, and then there's an ancilla, which says that there's no error. And this one, ZJ sidebar, goes to sidebar, this is the ancilla. And the ancilla says, well, its error is ZJ. We haven't corrected it yet, so it's there. Okay? Does everyone understand my notation here? Okay. And by linearity, therefore, this thing goes to the appropriate linear combination. It goes to cosine theta times this minus I sine theta times this. Okay? And the thing here is that the ancilla now has information about the error. And so when we measure the ancilla, these are orthogonal states, so we'll get one or the other, with probability cosine squared theta. We get this first case. And with probability sine squared theta, we get the second case. Okay? So this wishful thinking that it was had to be x, y, or z has somehow magically come true. That by measuring which one it was, we collapsed the superposition and turned it into actually one of the cases I or z. Okay? It's kind of magical. It's somehow quantum superposition and collapse is working the way we want it to, for sure. It's collapsing our errors into this discrete set that we already know how to deal with. Okay? And of course, this case, we don't have to do anything. This case, we need to correct the Z error, but the ancilla is telling us that it's a Z error, so we can do that just before. Okay? Any questions on that? And a little time to absorb that. Okay, well, we can come back to it if necessary. So this is one particular error, this continuous rotation. But you can see that kind of the same thing is going to hold in general. And maybe now is a good time to prove our first general theorem about quantum error correction. So you do that, I could probably define a quantum error corrected code. So how am I going to do that? Well, kind of sloppily maybe, but the basic idea is we have two Hilbert spaces. So we have a k-dimensional large Hilbert space. Well, that h of L, and an n-dimensional physical Hilbert space h of p. So normally, I mean, we don't have to, but frequently we'll consider the case where k is some number of qubits, this is small k qubits, and this is small n qubits. So k is 2 to the k and n is 2 to the n. But there's definition, we don't need that. And what we'd like to do is we'd like to embed this large Hilbert space in the physical space. We have some kind of unitary encoding. Which puts this in this. Oh, and I guess I need that k is less than n. So we're increasing the size of the Hilbert space. And we say that this is a this encoding is a quantum error correcting code. And frequently that's abbreviated QECC. For the set of errors E, and E is, I want to think of them as matrices acting on the Hilbert space. But they don't have to be unitary, they don't really have to be anything at this level of abstraction. And they certainly don't have to be CPQ graphs. So anyway, so we have a quantum error correcting code for a set of errors e.
Does it have to be a finite set?
No, it doesn't have to be. Well, we'll get back to that in a minute. Just for any set of errors acting on this physical Hilbert space. So it's quantum error correcting if there exists, now we do have to have a CPQ map, so it's some map R that maps this physical Hilbert space back to the logical Hilbert space. And so this is the recovery operation, or sometimes, or more frequently, the decoding. Such that for all states that we can encode, so states in a logical Hilbert space, and for all errors, R, well, it'll do kind of what you'd expect an error correcting code to do. It'll get rid of the error. So if we have E acting on the encoded state psi, so U remember is the encoder here. So U psi is something in the physical Hilbert space, the psi bar, if you will. And then E is the error acting on that. R will map this back to psi. And of course, what I mean by this, since R is a CPT map, if you want to define this rigorously, you have to take the density matrix that corresponds to the state. Well, I mean, might not be density matrix because the trace doesn't have to be same thing, but the kind of the formal thing that looks like this.
What's an example of a non-CPTV error?
I erased it. So for instance, if you look at the amplitude Dagenham channel, and you just look at A1, okay, so that would be an example, or projection just on 0, another thing that you can't have by itself.
These aren't really physically realizable errors.
That's right. So by themselves, they're not physically realizable. But mostly, I'm interested in the individual base of K that can appear in the cross representation. So by themselves, you can't realize them, but they could happen probabilistically as part of some bigger thing. But I'm not even really restricting to let's see, are those 8Ks completely general? They have to be less than 1. And I guess for this definition, it doesn't really matter whether any of that is true. But I think if they're greater than 1, then this can't be satisfied. So probably
is there a normalization for them?
Yes, that's an excellent point. So this is why I said it was being sloppy. So let's ignore normalization. So that seems like a really stupid thing to do. But remember, this has to be true for all things in the Hilbert space. So it has to get back superpositions to the right superposition. So what that means is that normalization is just going to be kind of an overall thing. It's going to be the same for all the states. And it's not completely obvious. You have to write that down. So the upside is that it turns out it's a probability. And so we can kind of ignore that. Yeah?
Can you remind us what the technical definition of the hook arrow is again? Is it to do with different sizes?
The technical definition of...
The arrow with the hook?
It's just saying that this is a one-to-one map. I mean, in this context, it's kind of trivial because I already said it was unitary. So that, I mean, it's not just one-to-one, it's actually the bijections and it's just, yeah, anyway. That's just kind of gratuitous. Redundancy. But redundancy is one of those principles of error correction.
If encoding and decoding are all CPTP, and E is not CPTP, so how can you map that?
Well, that's right. So this is really the question about normalization, is that what's going to happen is it's going to map it back, but somehow the probability is going to be wrong. So if it's something that's, if it's one of those 8Ks, what's going to happen is it's going to map it back, but there'll be some, if you look at the density matrix, so actually what's going to happen is we'll have this density matrix. Well, this won't be a density matrix, but this state will get mapped to something of this form. And we're kind of going to ignore this probability. Okay, and actually, again, if you look at the case where we have things that are not AKs that can be greater than 1, then this could even be greater than 1, which seems weird, but for the purpose of this definition, that's going to be okay.
So you want linearity at least. In the set of errors, you want each of them to be linear.
Yeah, that's right. So when I say it's acting on HP, maybe I should say acts linear. So these are linear things, matrices acting on this n-dimensional physical Hilbert space. Yeah.
Something. First of all, that should be E dagger on the right, because it's not necessarily.
Yes. And E dagger also.
Are you not keeping track of the cross terms? So if you have several elements E, you give them some index, and you would have like a term on the left.
So you might worry about that. It turns out all of that is going to work out. Basically, as a result of saying this is true for all psi in the Hilbert space rather than just basis case. The upshot is that mostly I like to think about these things in terms of doing things to pure states. And the fact that this is a CPT map, well, all I'm going to do is say that actually it's unitary when we throw in some extra qubits, which are these, like, and solas that we're using for measuring the errors. And then we throw them away at the end when we put them back down. So that kind of gets rid of a lot of these questions, right, if you phrase it better. But nevertheless, they're good questions. So keep them coming. No? Everyone satisfied for now? Okay. So now I need more vortex. Oh, I can go back there.
There's a third layer of force, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, but then I have to hide something. So the point is, if I'm going to hide it, I'm going to be able to erase it. I guess the block doesn't necessarily follow. Okay, so what I'd like to do is generalize this statement. And so here's our theorem. If the quantum error correction code corrects two errors A and B, so it corrects a set of errors that includes A and B, then it also corrects alpha A plus beta B. And the proof, well, is basically the same as this. Right? You just have to substitute A and B for I and Z, and it works exactly the same. When we measure the error syndrome, we tell which one we're in, and we collapse the state. Okay? And so in general, what this means is that if quantum error correcting code corrects some set of errors E, then it corrects the linear span of E. Again, there's maybe some issues about normalization, but basically, morally, this is true. You define it so that you ignore the normalization. Okay. Yeah.
So Daniel, in the short code, we got to know in the syndrome qubits what error occurred, right? So for example, here, so even in this QECC, you would want to know in the syndrome qubits what error occurred.
Yes.
Right. Because you want orthogonal output.
Well, so as it turns out, that's not actually necessary.
Did you want orthogonal outputs?
Well, so, yeah. So you're, what happens is your syndrome is telling you something.
Yeah.
And so whatever it's telling you, it's collapsing to those errors. And the point is that in this, well, okay, there's a kind of couple of special cases. But basically, if you have two things that are giving you different syndromes, there'll be some other errors in this span that will actually give you orthogonal syndromes. Right, kind of by Brown's permit or something, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I think if you actually write out this thing in the general case, you don't even really need to go through that step. It's maybe helpful to think about that. Satisfactory? You can write it down yourself if you don't believe it. It's not very hard.
Basically, you consider an equivalent set of errors where now you're able to get orthogonal output.
Well, yeah, so that's one way of thinking about it. But actually, the point of this theorem is that I can expand the set of errors to include anything that's a linear combination with my original set of errors. So it's not really equivalent. It's just that we don't need to do any extra error correction to correct extra errors.
No, so the expansion would occur only when you actually can detect whether it was A or B, right? I mean, suppose that I had a way of correcting without detecting whether it was exactly A or exactly B.
Yeah.
Then, I mean, at least this argument wouldn't go through, right? That Measure.
Well,
control.
So yeah, so it's not literally the same here, but I mean, if you write it down, here's another point that is worth saying now or some other time. It's not actually literally necessary that I measure the ancilla to go from here to here. Okay, so this is why you don't have to go through this stage before talking about it. That was just convenient for how to present it. All that's necessary is that you do a controlled operation from here to here to correct the error. And then what happens, suppose we hadn't measured the ancilla. You could have delayed that until after doing this correction. Well, then what happens is you have the same state psi in the data, or psi bar in the data. And the ancilla then has information about the error. So what happens is you've transferred the information about the error from the physical Hilbert space into the ancilla. So in the case you're talking about, that still happens. So there's, I haven't explained to you how to actually do the correction in general, but we'll get to that.
Just part of the confusion also is in the meaning of alpha A plus beta B. Right? So if A and B are thought of as cross operators, then alpha A plus beta B means something, but if you think of them as CPTP maps, then what is...
But I'm thinking of them as cross operators. And that was explicit up there, right? Well, maybe I didn't write it down. It depends on how you interpret them. But I did say that very explicitly. I'm thinking of them as matrices, not as CPTP operators. Matrices acting on state vectors, rather than... Anyway, the point of this is that, in fact, the non-qubit code, now we know that it's going to correct one general error. So how do we know that? Just squeeze this into the bottom here. If we take the poly matrices I, X, Y, and Z, and take all possible linear combinations back, we get all 2x2 matrices. And so the upshot is that any code that can correct I, X, Y, and Z on any single qubit can correct any one qubit error. And therefore, this non-qubit code can correct any one qubit error. And certainly that's true if we have the unitary operation, because we can think of it that way. But again, because we're not restricting these E's to be unitary, it works even if we have a general single qubit quantum count. Because then we can each possible thing is one of those AKs. And the AKs are still in this span. Okay, and therefore can be corrected. So, add that here. List here. Okay, so we did this before, and now we've done this. So we solved all the problems, and we have a quantum error correction code that corrects any one qubit error. Okay? But that's an accomplishment. Okay, so in the remaining time, I'd like talk about some more general properties of code. Now that I've proved first general theorem, we can now talk about the general properties that a quantum error correcting code has to have. What conditions does it have to satisfy? How do we know if something in general, somebody just gives you an encoding, how do you know whether it's a quantum error correcting code or not? Okay. So, in general, if we want to correct a two-qubit error instead of just a one-qubit error, well, it's not enough to look at just x, y, and z. We have to look at some other basis. Well, in general, that's what we have to do. We have to look at some. We have two-qubit errors. We don't have to correct the basis of two-qubit errors. So what's a basis? Well, one good basis is actually just tensor products of quantum matrices. So let's define something that I call the poly group. There's slight variance of this, they go by other names. So the poly group is consists of consists of n qubit tensor products of the one qubit poly matrices, I, X, Y, and Z. And in order to make it a group, we're going to need to close it by adding an overall phase. It could be plus or minus 1 or plus or minus 9. So for instance, for the two qubit poly group, we have things like X tensor X, or I times Y tensor Z. I guess I could write that down, so it means I in two different ways. Okay. And this is a group that has a lot of nice properties. First of all, it carries over, well, almost, the two properties from the one qubit poly group. So it has the property that, let's call this P, and maybe P sub n, since it has n qubits. So if you have any P in P sub n, then you have P squared is equal to plus or minus the identity. Okay? And the reason that we have minus the identity is because we have the space factor of I. So if we have just straight tensor products of I, X, Y, and Z squares to the identity, we have I, or minus I, times such a tensor product, squares to minus 1. So that's one property. Another property is given any two things in the poly group, then either they commute or they anti-commute. And you can tell just by looking at a single qubit case. So for instance, these two commute because X and Y anti-commute, X and Z anti-commute. So that gives us 2 minus 1, so we try to move them past each other, which is a plus 1. On the other hand, X tensor X would anti-commute with X tensor Y. Okay? And of course, that's another important property. Of course, the reason I'm bringing them up now is that if we take the linear span of P sub n, we get all n cubed matrices. So in particular, if we take the span of all t cubed bottom matrices, we'll get all matrices acting on t qubits. Okay? So that motivates the following definition. The weight of a poly operator is just the number of non-identity factors. So for instance, X, tensor I, tensor I has weight 2, as would Z, tensor I, tensor X, tensor I. Okay? And so my claim then is that the weight T poly errors form a basis for all T qubit errors. For contrast, I know, with the light erase form, maybe a reason to use the third layer. Okay? Does everyone understand these definitions? Yeah?
But T cubic errors were defined as a set of sigmas.
Yeah, so I'm being a little sloppy here. Really, I guess what I mean is that they form a basis for all the AKs that could appear in such a sigma. So for the by applying this theorem, basically that means, well, okay, so I didn't define what it means for quantum error compared to correct a CP map. But probably can figure it out. So what I mean is that this is form a basis for all matrices acting on just T out of the n qubits.
Which forms the basis if all the cross operators can be expressed in a linear combination.
Yeah. So any cross operator that could appear in such a CP map can be written.
If we can correct those, isn't that stronger than correcting only T cubic error sigmas?
Sorry, correct all of which. Oh, yes, that's right. So in some sense it is. But of course, physically, we only have to worry about errors with your CP maps. So while mathematically it means we can correct more, it just kind of never comes up.
Actually not, because, I mean, a great T Pauli operator is also a T qubit. I mean, yeah.
I mean, you're right, that a priori mathematically this is stronger. But in practice, at the level of quantum error correction, they're all equivalent. That being able to do one thing implies being able to do the other. So it's maybe not worth making the fine distinctions about this.
That theorem on the second board, yeah.
Yeah, so it, certainly if you can correct any T qubit error in the CP sense, then you can correct any poly error, right? Because that's a possibility. And by this theorem, if you can correct any poly error, then you can correct kind of anything else, including broader. And I should say that this also answers kind of Ackman's question from before, which is, well, could I define the T qubit error as things where the AKs, were sums of T qubit operations? And the answer is yes, I could have, because of this theorem, I would have been able to correct those automatically as well. But again, I don't think it's really worth it to find distinctions because they all come in for free.
Just
Just a quick check on the definition of span. Of course, normally zero is in the span, and...
Yes, well, zero is kind of corrected trivially, because it never happens. So the probability of it, if you look at that normalization, is zero. So is that the only part of the question, or...?
Oh, well, and might be close to zero, just whether...
Well, close to zero, that's okay, because now there's something left. And so it happens very rarely, but when it does happen, there's got to be information that we can use to recover the state. This definition doesn't, since we're assuming that it's one of these errors in the set E, and there's no chance of having something outside, it doesn't have any tolerance for imperfections. We have to get exactly the original state in that definition. You could relax that, but that's a whole other question. Yeah?
Cross operators don't necessarily have to be square matrices, but is it the case that all CP maps can be written as square matrices?
So that's a good question. So it's not, you could extend this definition and all these results pretty easily to the case where your maps take the physical Hilbert space to some Hilbert space of a different size. It tends to be most convenient to think about them as acting on the same size Hilbert space. So I guess, for instance, the erasure errors that I talked about technically act on give you a bigger Hilbert space out of the end. But really, this extra register that tells you where the errors are, that's kind of classical information, so you use it somewhere else. So mostly, we think about them acting on the same size of Hilbert space. One way to think about that is if it acts on a small, if you end up with a smaller Hilbert space, you can think of it as just part of the physical space HP. And if it's a bigger Hilbert space, well, then you expand the original HP to be kind of the space that you end up with at the end. So in that sense, it's okay to think about it as always acting, as always being a square. Yeah.
So Daniel, I guess when we're talking about decoherence, just there's one more thing that we have to note, that not just that we can tackle the linear combination, but the convex one.
Well, that's right. I didn't really say this very explicitly because I didn't define exactly what it means to correct a CP map. But if we can correct all of the AKs, then sensibly we can correct the convex combination, because if every one of those happens to happen, we'll get it back to the original state. Okay. Let's see. So, plug group. So now we're ready to go on to actually get quantum error correction conditions. So maybe now I'll use one of these pristine behind boards. Okay, so how are we going to do that? Well, thinking about it, one thing that would be sufficient to correct errors would be if everything that happened took us to some orthogonal state. So here's a sufficient condition. So we have possible basis states, encoded basis states. Psi I bar. And, well, they're certainly going to be orthogonal to each other because they're basis states. And we have some basis errors. EA. Okay? Now, suppose each time we had a different EA acting on a different psi I, we got something that's orthogonal to all of the others. Okay. Then we could make some measurement that would lock together the psi i's to tell us exactly which EA we have. Right? And then once we know which EA we have, we can take that Hilbert space that's spanned. Okay. So We have the possible set of states, EA, psi I bar, all orthogonal. And so what this means is, so we make the following measurement. We have the various subspaces spanned by the constant EA, constant value thing, the different basis states. Okay, so this is one subspace. So we have a subspace that's spanned by these states. We can make some measurement that will tell us which value of A. And then given A, so this subspace has the same dimension as the original Hilbert space. And since these are all orthogonal, we can take these states, now SA back to the original Markov Hilbert space by mapping EA psi I bar just to psi I bar. Right? So what is this condition? Well, so if we write this out, this is just saying that psi I bar EA dagger EB psi k bar. So this is one such state, and this is the broad version of the other such state. So these could be orthogonal. So if A is not equal to B, it could be 0. And if I is not equal to K, it should be 0. Okay? So this is a sufficient condition.
So here you're taking trace preserving errors.
No. No. It's the all I'm saying, well, okay. Okay, that's a very good point. In fact, it was going to be one of my next points. This is a sufficient condition. So, but you're right that in order for this to be satisfied, the EAs have to be trace preserving. But that's kind of silly. All we care about is that these states have the same norm as each other, and then there'll be some overall probability of having this happen. So really, it's enough if we stick in some factor C sub A here. So long as it's the same, it doesn't depend on the state psi I, we can still do all of this. Okay, does everyone agree with that? Yes?
Is that CA times CB, or is that CB?
Well, so it's, since we have this delta AB, it's kind of irrelevant. So this is, basically, this is, I mean, it could be a function of A and B if you like, but that's not adding it. Other questions? Okay, and of course, based on this theorem over here, it's not really necessary that this be true for any particular basis. It just has to be true for some basis, the variables. Still agree with that? Okay, so it turns out that once we've added those two generalizations, we no longer have just a sufficient condition, but a sufficient and necessary condition. So let's prove that. Okay. This theorem is the quantum error correction conditions. And says that the following are proven statements. First, we have a set of states that form a basis. For quantum error correcting code, correcting some set of errors E. And of course, by the previous theorem, it would be sufficient to say, it would be equivalent if we said E were spent. Condition D is almost like that, but we'll have to do a little bit of massaging to get it there. And it says, by I bar, in A dagger, in B, slash J bar, is equal to some matrix, CAB, delta IJ, where, this is true for all EA, EB in the set E. And kind of the and of course it's for all on J. And kind of the content of this is that CAB does not depend on I and J. And the third version that I want to consider is so now we're going to go beyond basis states and go beyond basis errors. So we'll say that this is equal to C of E. So delta I j has disappeared because it's the same state here. But this has to be true for all sidebar in the code, and for all E in span. So this time we have to look at the span. Whereas for these two, it could be either way. Yeah?
Well, for your sufficient condition just put there, doesn't imply that your B here is a diagonal matrix, your CAB?
No. So when I wrote that, it was intended as a sufficient condition. And then I added some extra caveats. So the difference is, so I said over here that this was actually sufficient and necessary. But it's only sufficient and necessary if this is true for some basis EA. Actually, let me change this. So let's call this FA to avoid this confusion. Okay, with these sufficient and necessary conditions are true for any basis. EA, EB. Where EA, EB are drawn from any basis. Okay? So that's the distinction. And so in that case, CAB doesn't have to be that. And in fact, we've already encountered a code where it does not that, the 9-qubit code, when EA are drawn from poly matrices. The 9-qubit code is not that. And that's one of the problems on the problem set that I've been having out in a few minutes. Okay. So let's quickly prove this. So the proof is pretty simple. So I'll just kind of sketch it. So to go from B to A, well, we apply the sufficient condition. And to do that, we have to somehow get from this to the diagonal matrix. Well, but note that CAB is actually a Hermitian matrix, because if you take the adjoint, well, then you switch I and J, A and B here on the left. right? And I took an IK, it gives you still delta IK here. But it gives you the actual here. Yeah. So, wait, is it Mishan or symmetric? Either way, it's diagonalizable. So, you can diagonalize CAB by choosing a different basis. And then you get that sufficient condition that we had over there. So that tells us that we have a quantum error correcting code. Okay, so what's next? We can go from A to C. That's a little bit harder. That's kind of the, well, that part is the less time trivial part, but this is the second less time trivial part. So remember, we have this recovery operation, which we can extend to a unitary when we're throwing away qubits. So we can think of it that way. So we have this unitary and so we have, we're going from A to C, so we want to consider this state E, and this is going to be, has to be something times sidebar times some state of the ancilla. Right? And similarly, if we had some different encoded state phi bar, this should be some other constant times phi bar times some other state of the ancilla. Okay? But this has to be true for all states in code. It also has to be true for psi plus phi. So we have to have U, E on psi bar plus phi bar. Sorry, this is decoded, so there's no bars here. Psi bar plus phi bar has to equal some other constant, C, times psi plus phi times some other ancilla. But by linearity, this has to equal this plus this. And that can't be true unless A equals B. So why is that? Well, let's assume that these ancillas are properly normalized so that we can make this statement sensible. And then you'll see that we've adjusted the relative size of psi and phi, which is not going to be consistent with this case. We're doing the same size in superposition. You can prove that a little more mathematically if you prefer, but this is true. If you look at this combination, since this is a U is unitary, it has to preserve the norm from the left side and the right side. And the U disappears if you take that combination. And so if you take the norm of this, you get this. And if you take the norm of this, well, these have a norm 1, and so we get A squared. And that's equal to B squared, which is the norm of this thing. Okay? And this equation is this one. Okay? Okay, and then to finish off, have to prove. So we have to prove that C implies B, and that's just a little bit of arithmetic. So the arithmetic, I'll leave to you, but I'll give you a pointer if I do it, which is consider the cases where we let E equal EA plus or minus EB, and EA plus or minus IEB. Plug those in, you get a bunch of linear equations. And when you solve them, you get a condition that looks like this. And similarly, you can then consider psi bar is equal to psi I bar plus or minus psi j bar and psi bar plus or minus I psi j bar, and you get condition B out. Again, same thing when you're afraid. Okay? And that proves these finite error correction conditions. Now, unfortunately, for the problem set, you need a couple more things. So let me do those pretty quickly. So what we can do is we can define the distance of the quantum error correcting code. Motivated by these quantum error correction conditions as the minimum weight poly operator P for which we want P is now not a single one of these EAs, but the product of two of them. And the distance is the minimum weight such that the corresponding combination here fails to satisfy this condition. Okay? So in other words, as a corollary of this theorem, the quantum error correcting code of distance 2t plus 1 will correct t qubit errors. Right? Because if we take t qubit poly operators for EA and t qubit poly operators for AB, well, the product of those could be 2t. A weight 2t poly operator. But the code of distance 2t plus 1 will have this condition hold for things up to weight 2t. So the quantum error correcting condition will hold, and that code will correct those t qubit errors that we started with. And similarly, a quantum error correcting code of distance d in general will correct d minus 1 qubit erasure errors. Another thing you can show, but I won't do it now, is that the quantum error correcting code of distance d will detect d minus 1 errors. So if you only want to know that an error has happened but not what error were, you don't want to try to correct it if there was an error. So you want to know, if there was no error, then the state is fine. If there was an error, then I'll throw it away. You just want to know which case it is. So in that case, you can correct up to error on d-minus 1 qubits. Sorry, tech. Okay, so the very last thing I want to show is another form of these error correction conditions. And so now we have to go back to density matrices. So if we think of the condition in this form, well, or the, at least of the version that we use for definition of distance, well, this is equal to trace of rho e, right, where rho is and e is something that's acting on, so for distance decode, we know something about this behavior in the case where we're interested, where e acts on up to d minus 1 qubits. So let's focus on some particular d minus 1 qubits. Then we can consider taking the trace in two steps. So we can trace over the qubits other than those d minus 1, and then trace over those d minus 1. And that's, of course, equal to taking the trace overall. So we can say that sidebar d sidebar is equal to the trace over these d minus 1 qubits. If E is only acting on these D minus 1 qubits, and then we can take the trace on the remaining qubits inside here and act only on the rho, because E is acting on the identity on those other qubits. So we can let that be rho D minus 1, which is the trace over the others, of rho. Okay, so we have some particular set of d minus 1 qubits, and we have arbitrary error e, and we know that this is independent of psi. Okay, so what we have here is a statement that if we take the trace of any matrix with the density operator of these d minus 1 qubits, what we get doesn't depend on the state. So in particular, we can consider, since we can take any matrix, not just, say, the Pauli matrices. We can set, for instance, E to be the matrices that have 1, 1 somewhere and zeros elsewhere. And therefore, we get that the ij component of rho d minus 1 is independent of psi. So in particular, rho d minus 1 itself is independent of psi. So the density matrix of the qubits on these d minus 1, sorry, the density matrix of these d minus 1 qubits has no information at all. It's completely independent about the encoded state. And in fact, this is equivalent to the statement that the Q quantum marker can code has distance d. Okay? So that's one way we can think about this definition of distance. That it's saying that the environment doesn't gain any information when it acts in only d minus 1 qubits. No matter what it does, it can't learn anything about the encoded state. And if you think about it, that's kind of good, right? Because if it did learn information about the encoded state, then it could collapse the superposition. Okay. So that's it for today. Next time, when we get back, we're going to talk about kind of a general formalism for thinking about quantum codes and look at some more specific and more efficient codes than the 9-qubit code. So here's the problem set up here. I don't know if the most efficient way is to hand it around or have people just come up and grab it if you want it. So the first few of these have here. I'll divide it into sections. And you can divide up further and spread out. So the first few of those are double-sided, but most of them are two-digit tables. But they're the same concept. And if there's anyone who didn't sign this sign-up sheet, please do that. For the people who didn't get the syllabus and questionnaire, they're here. For those who did get them, please, I would appreciate it if you fill out the questionnaire and give it back to me. Again, not necessary, but it's helpful.